No, I know I'm getting older, because there's a point where there'd be like a lot of bands with the like whole like angry metal aesthetic. Like, that's awesome. Now I'm at the point where like, who are you trying to impress? Are you still mad at your fucking dad? You know, I mean, like, there's like the ones that are kind of grandfathered in,
mm-hmm.
that I get and that I still like, you know, like, I'm not going to lie, I'm not the world's biggest Metallica fan, but I like Metallica, you know. There's like Iron Maiden. There's like, mm-hmm. you know, the ones that like, you know, our generation and things before our generation that I like. But a lot of the shit that when I see people just by this point, I don't know, maybe because I've seen it so many times before, but like, I guess even something like Kiss is like, because there's like, even though like people thought they were like the spawn of Satan at the time, just like, you thought this was the fucking spawn of Satan. One of them's dressed like a fucking cat. Are you kidding me? But then there's like, but it's like, there's kind of a funness to it. There's a funness to it. Kind of like, because you're talking about, you just got back from the Wednesday 13 concert and there's a funness to it. But mm-hmm. when they start doing the like, I'm just angry and I'm mad all the time, and we just gotta rage. And, like, that shit just gets so fucking old to me. I'm like, okay, you're still pissed at your dad. I get it. All right. Fuck.
Well, then there's like those bands where like they have the first album. The first album's like punk rock, hey, fight the power, we're doing it, something like that. And then it's like the second album comes, it's just like, oh shit, money's kind of nice. You know what? I've been on vacation this whole last 6 months, you know. And then the fans are like, but that second album was all soft. Like, what was going on there, man? Like, you know, when I think of it, it's like, and I like these other albums, but it's like Cage the Elephant. Like, that first album's very like, whoa, we're angry, all stuff. And then it's almost like, oh shit, we made a bunch of money, we're doing good. Oh, huh. Don't got as much stuff to be angry about anymore. Let's just have a good time.
I'll be honest. I think I like their third album the most, but at the same time, their first album is a lot. Their third album is probably like their angriest album. And then like a little bit of money came in, and then like second album, like, you know what? You know, I think we can get by on this. This feeling pretty good. And then the third album, just like, hey man, let's be introspective and just like embrace life. Where the first album, it's like half the songs, they're like complaining about like an ex-girlfriend or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we were just saying about the Wednesday 13 show is he was doing his Murder Dolls. And this is for like, nobody ever seems to know Wednesday 13 when I mentioned him out there very, you know, it's like one of those ones. It's like, you could have somebody that looks like they're all in the metal. They like horror movies. They feel like they should like have at least crossed paths at least at some point with Wednesday 13 or Murder Dolls or something like that. And it's literally like a shot in the dark. Like it almost never does, you know, it's one of those ones, be like, well, you like Marilyn Manson, you like Rob Zombie, you know, you like Misfits, never heard of Wednesday 13. Okay. But yeah,
to be fair, he is kind of like, I mean, you're the one that I wouldn't have known about him unless you introduced me to him. So that's kind of, we went to go see him one time in, was it Fresno?
Yeah, Fresno.
Yeah, it was Fresno. And we were like, it was like, there's a bunch, it was the weirdest lineup of bands, and we will get to From Dusk Till Dawn. It's just like, I think Wednesday 13 is fitting for Halloween, you know. We went to go see Wednesday 13, and it was like the weirdest lineup of bands. It was first kind of like a deathcore band, which was very fitting for the time, like an emo, like more of a screamo core kind of band, like, which was fitting for the time because it was like 2010, 2011, something like that.
Yeah.
And then there was like kind of like an 80s synth band. And I'll never forget what you told me, because they were all very like just done up, just very like, just this kind of very like keyboard synth, kind of very 80s pop. And there's one guy who was a very good looking guy, but he had like his shirt unbuttoned. He had a very nice jawline. He had like a pompadour, and the whole time he was like puckering his lips. And every time you turned me, he said,
had the hairy chest popping out, you know, because they had like the mod rock thing going, like a, you know.
Yeah, like it was like they were very styled, and they were like, you know, like these guys, like if it was the 80s, they would have been like scoring all fucking night. But they probably did good that night too, actually. But anyway, I remember you leaned into me, you said, like, that dude is either very Italian or very gay. I don't know which one. It's just because the way the guy was looking. I can't tell. Maybe it's both.
Yeah, because the guy had like such like he was almost straight out like, if it's, you know, I know Saturday Night Fever does have an 80s sequel, but like if it was more kept in tune with like that and didn't become more like a musical thing, you know, I feel like that's almost like what it was. It had that kind of feel to it. And he was just really like, you know, puckering his lips and stuff, and, you know, pumping the eye. It's like, you know, if there was probably the right audience, but the, you know, let's be honest, mostly everybody that was there for Wednesday 13 was the core thing, but it was that weird one where like they were jamming everybody in. They're like, who's free in Fresno tonight? Okay. And then we forgot there was also, there's that band started off that was like that zombie zisk, like,
oh, right.
You know,
they're
like hippie kind of. Yeah.
They're like, I actually remember the name of that band. The name of the, it was the most emo named band, but they're actually probably one of the best shows there. They're called I Do Not Exist. And, but at the same time, I remember that because I had like one of their stickers on my computer for a while. But they were like a kind of 60s kind of surf rock psychedelic kind of thing. And I remember they were actually pretty good. But then like the one before, like then there was, you know, the screamo band, then the 80s synth band, the 80s synth pop band, and then the dad rock We Wish We Were Black Label Society band. Wednesday 13,
which really, that I will say that the biker band did have its share of audience there. Like there was like a good quarter of people that were totally there for them, so maybe they were a big, like, you know, Fresno area something. Oh, yeah. But yeah, like none of these bands really matched. That was the closest kind of match to Wednesday 13. Everything else was still like close, like, yeah, it's under the rock category, but it's not really the same thing, but okay, sure, you know. Which, you know, I kind of started thinking about, but you know what, it's that was still like in the recession period, so it's probably like people were taking any gig they can get. Fill them in. Yeah. I don't care where we play tonight, who the hell cares. What, you say it's 20 bucks in, you know, in a Pabst? Okay, I'm there.
$20, case of Pabst, and oh, look, they're serving pizza across the street for $2 each. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's one of those ones. Because that was a show where we got to meet Wednesday 13, which I've never seen ever since then. And I think, and Kyle's the one that brought that up, because he's like, wait, what year was it again? 2010? He's like, well, it's probably the recession. He's like, he needed to get anybody and everybody in as close as possible, you know?
Yeah. I remember because like he was kind of leading in, because everyone in the band was all like black eyeshadow and pale. So one person would come on stage at a time, like, is that him? Oh, no, it's not him. Is that him? Oh, no, it's not him. So it's like, if you're going to play in his band, you got to look like him. You got to be like one of like the president's like body devils in case a gunman comes out. You know?
Well, that's totally how it is. It's like, yeah, they all look like Wednesday 13, especially like if you haven't seen him for the first time in concert. You're like, oh, wait, you know? Oh, no, that's not him.
Because they all, except for the exception of like the guitar player, they all had long hair too. So.
Yeah, because the guitar player like shaved half his head, which you know there was discussion after that point.
Yeah.
Whoa, what are you trying to do?
Someone's got some fucking ideas, huh? Someone's trying to step out of fucking line.
but yeah.
Yeah, maybe I would start a band called Tuesday 12. Like, oh, you motherfucker, you better not.
He'd be one day up above me. But yeah, but then we just saw him recently it was in Reno, and he was doing the Pure Murder Dolls one, which if anybody knows anything, it's probably they might know Murder Dolls, because it has Joey Jordison in the initial lineup. Because that's kind of what happened, is Wednesday 13 was such an underground band, and Joey Jordison's like, dude, this guy's awesome. Like, I'm going to play with him, and we're going to kind of get more exposure. You know, and it worked for like a brief, you know, that six-month window probably in 2003. I remember being in 2003, because I remember being in eighth grade and Kyle got that album or whatever it came out, and he was really into it, that he went to the area we hung out at and wrote Murder Dolls in a big wax pen on the side of the wall. So it was there at school for like graffiti the whole time. And it's like, damn it, Kyle, this is where we stand. They're going to totally blame us for it.
He's like, I left my fucking mark.
I don't know why that kind of reminds me of like literally like same year. There was another time that Kyle came by and we're all just like sort of hanging out, because Kyle just like free roamed this time period and just like, you know, went all kinds of different places. He took this apple, chucked it up as high as possible in the air. It came down, exploded everywhere, and then just walked off. Why? I don't know exactly. Don't know what the backstory
my
of this
point
was.
My point was made, and he just leaves.
Yeah, yeah, he was doing some kind of expression.
Newton was right. Like, he tried to make it sound like there was like some deeper meaning behind it.
You know? Well, lo and behold, about 45 minutes later, like, one of the yard dudes comes in, you know, signals out everybody but Kyle to go out and go clean that apple up.
Is this the yard duty that was in like the we'll get to the topic in a second, but like, is this the yard duty and the like little golf cart thing? Like, hey, like, it was always hard to have respect for a yard duty at a golf cart, just like running around yelling at kids, pointing.
Yeah, she broke her ankle at one point. They gave her a golf cart, and then when the ankle healed, she never gave back the golf cart.
Which everyone made jokes about, like, oh, she's giving life. I bet that she probably drives. She can't get into her house anymore because she won't leave the golf cart. You know, people made those kind of jokes or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same point, at that age, like, really, if you got the golf cart, why wouldn't you fucking use it? You know, we were all like laugh, like, haha, you fucking suck. You drive around in a golf cart. You can't fucking walk like a regular person. But then when you stop and think about it, like, as like an adult, you're like, well, I got the fucking golf cart. Well, I mean, I gotta be practical here. If I have it, you know, should I use it? You kind of a waste of money.
It's one of those ones. It's like, hey, I was literally thinking yesterday, I was looking at this golf course. And so I'm like, you know, I'm like, the golf course is really like the biggest, like, rich person's child fantasy you can imagine. Cause it's just a bunch of guys are going like, hey, you know what I want to do? I want to go out and play on the field, swing a stick around with my buddies and drive go-karts. Like, that sounds like a 10-year-old's fantasy. I'm going to be out all day long on the field, on the green grass, you know, swinging a stick, you know, a metal stick at that, too. Like, I've upgraded from a wooden stick, you know, and we drive golf carts. Or, you know.
I mean, I'm sure something like Jackass has done something like this, but like, have, like, lifted golf carts with bigger tires and just kind of going off-road and doing that shit. I can see that being fun, kind of do some, like, you know, Mad Max golf cart shit.
I'm
for that.
I mean, they sort of do make those. They're like, they're kind of made for hunting and so on like that, but you'll see them every once in a while where they're just these, like, rugged, like, outdoor. they're like a Can-Am, but not exactly a Can-Am. It's more just like a golf course.
You're more like a quad. Like, oh, I guess the quads would work too, but like, I guess I'm just like golf carts.
But you can't fit four people in your case of beer in there while you're driving around.
You could double dash some shit, you know? Someone's in the back just throwing stuff, you know? I mean, I really think that's where Mad Max got the idea for, like, you know, like having, like, get me my spear, boy! You know? So, I really think, like, oh, like, I think, like, what's his name? I think George Miller was playing a lot of Mario Kart Double Dash. Like, I got some ideas. You gotta wait for, like, when the world is ready.
Exactly. It all kind of comes together there. But even with Wednesday 13 and so on, I'm actually kind of tying this into From Dusk Till Dawn. I'm actually surprised I don't think he has a From Dusk Till Dawn song. You know, he's got, like, practically every other horror movie known to mankind. I know, of course, From Dusk Till Dawn would have been a little bit newer in the repertoire from, like, his 70s, 80s kind of roster, or 60s, 70s, 80s roster. So, but still, kind of surprising that's actually not in there. Or at least I can't think of one. Maybe there is. I'm just, because he's got more songs than, like, pretty much almost most artists out there.
I mean, because he does have a lot of, like, horror, like, specific horror movie songs. So you think, yeah, there may be would be a if he has a Rambo one, you think he'd go like horror films before he goes Rambo. So, but at the same time, yeah, I guess it all at the same time, it's kind of like, I guess you could still, even though it's one of the greatest, one of the biggest directors of all time has a hand in this movie. I guess this still is kind of a cult movie because you still get people saying, oh, he directed this. You get people thinking he directed it, or thinking that, like, oh, wait, he actually directed this? I thought he was just in it for a minute, you know?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the interesting thing from Dusk Till Dawn, because it's that one that's, like, you know, it's in that Tarantino category, like, because he even, like, in that there was that Tarantino box set that had pretty much every single movie except for Natural Born Killers, of course, you know, because he just hates Oliver Stone to, like, a passion. And it's like, but it still has From Dusk Till Dawn in there too, because it's kind of interesting, because that's like the only one. It's like, well, he's not director, but that's, he got the writing thing on. And then I kind of forgot too that it's realistically, it's a story by Robert Kurtzman, you know, the guy who did makeup and special effects from like the 70s on up forever, and like almost every horror movie and so on that you can kind of think of. He's involved somehow, some way. And so he had this idea, and what he did is he hired Tarantino, which I totally forgot all about this stuff. I just thought this was one of Tarantino's original three scripts that he sort of had that goes along with True Romance, this, and Natural Born Killers. But instead, Tarantino was hired to write this, so he kind of went along with it, and this was his first hired paid gig thing. And I guess that makes more sense why he's not the director, and like why it's like, yeah, let's just do a team up thing. You know, we'll get all kinds of people involved in this project and we'll just have fun.
Well, it's also kind of interesting because later Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez would come out together with Grindhouse and do their double feature project where, you know, Rodriguez put out Planet Terror and Tarantino put out Death Proof. Watching this, you kind of see like this is a much earlier version of that. And in all honesty, better than both those movies, in my opinion. I mean, I still really like Planet Terror and I like Death Proof. Yeah. But I think this is ultimately a better movie than both those. And it just kind of like you see like the early stages of that. And it's kind of interesting because I think when you I didn't know that he was hired to write this movie, but now knowing he was hired, it kind of makes a lot more sense. Because sometimes, like, as you watch it, it still feels like parts of the dialogue feel like a Tarantino movie, but other parts of the dialogue don't feel as much as that. But that also could come into play as, well, it's a different director. And on top of that, he's writing a very different type of movie, a movie that he usually wouldn't write. He never really dives into, I'm trying to think here, other than this, he's never really dived into, like, science fiction. He's dived in like surrealism and like, you know, like tongue-in-cheek, like this would never happen in the real world. But I mean, by Kill Bill
Django has like, you know, the action's more over the top than like
over the top. Yeah, like more over the top action, that kind of thing. Or like Uma Thurman, like, oh, it's just this Japanese code of honor. You can carry a sword with you if you're going to Japan, you know, no one's going to stop you. You know, like just that kind of like tongue in cheekness of it. But at the same time, this is the first one and only one that I can think of that's actually that where it's straight up like horror fantasy, you know. So the dialogue probably lends itself differently.
Yeah, no, because that's the thing is it's definitely different, though it still feels very, very Tarantino, just especially even from like the beginning, because it has that sort of feel that it's almost the interesting thing that I always loved about this movie is the fact that it starts off almost in that same kind of category as Natural Born Killers / True Romance, has that feel as it starts. And then it sort of shifts and goes full Grindhouse, you know, halfway into the movie, you know, from like a, you know, a dark, almost like, you know, heist gangster flick, then into a full on, you know, kind of zombie vampire, you know, trapped in like a bottle film kind of area, blasting their way out, you know, last survivors type movie.
And I know we use this a lot, and he's not the only guy who made these kind of movies, but he's what comes to mind. So I'm just going to say it. Kind of like that Sam Peckinpah. When I think Sam Peckinpah style inspired movies, I think of movies that are basically modern day Westerns. They take place like in Texas or south of the border, and they usually involve dudes in muscle cars, and it has that kind of like we're on the run type thing, you know, like things like Two Guns or Way of the Gun, something to that effect. And this movie definitely starts off with that and this very real world situation. It just suddenly flips. And a lot of people at the time, I think now since people know what it is, they're a little bit more open to it with time hindsight. But at the time, a lot of people were like, what the fuck is this? I was enjoying this like dark crime film that had like these Western undertones. And then it suddenly becomes this very campy 80s like monster movie.
Well, the big thing is that Pulp Fiction only came out, you know, 2 years before this movie.
True.
So nobody knew who Tarantino was. Reservoir Dogs kind of comes out, you know, that becomes kind of, in a sense, its own kind of gangster cult hit. And then Pulp Fiction's the one that becomes like, oh, this movie's huge. This is one of the biggest movies of the year. You know, all this kind of stuff, got all this acclaim. You're getting people that normally wouldn't watch something like that to watch this. And then when they see this, I think there's a lot of people that, like, you know, not film buffs and not people that are really into cinema and all the different variations and genres and so on like that. they see this one, and then they go, what the fuck? That's the same guy that did Pulp Fiction? You know what I mean? And that's him right there? He's a rapist? Like, what the hell's going on in this? I think that was the thing that, like, really threw everything off, like, in this movie for, like, those people. Like, in hindsight, it doesn't seem weird at all. You add up all Tarantino's movies, you know, along with Robert Rodriguez and someone like that, and it feels like, oh, it fits in there totally, naturally. But I think at that point, when the average person knew Pulp Fiction, maybe new Reservoir Dogs, but even at that point, that still might have been, you know, you might not have caught Reservoir Dogs right off the bat, because I don't think that was just the easiest movie to go see in theaters when it came out. And I don't think, you know, unless, you know, you caught it at the video store or something like that, you know, you're still at that time period where if someone doesn't tell you about the movie yet, you might not have heard anything about it.
Yeah, and something else about this movie that I think stands out about it is, like, you in, like, through lines of dialogue and mostly through, like, the first 5 minutes, and then any dialogue by Seth Gecko and a little bit of Harvey Keitel. Everyone else doesn't seem like they're really as much of a Tarantino character. They seem like they can be kind of anything, really, you know, because everyone just talks basically. I mean, I'm not saying that they're bad or they're flat, but they just don't have that, because, like, a lot of Tarantino movies are like, even if the stakes are dire and we're all about to die, it's kind of like, let's hang out, let's get to know everyone. And even though there is a little bit of that when they are all in the RV and they're trying to get across the border, there's still kind of a sense of urgency, and it's always kind of Seth Gecko kind of controlling everything. And he very much seems like he could have been part of, like he would have ties to multiple people from Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, you know, like he seems like somebody who could have easily been on that crew and easily been on that jewel heist that went wrong. So, like, he kind of stands out in that way as a Tarantino character, but everyone else, this is where I say it does feel a little bit more like work for hire. And that's not a bad thing, because this is probably, I like this more than some of his movies he's directed. It just feels a little bit more of like, just keep in mind, this is like probably my favorite or second favorite Rodriguez movie. I don't know. But like at the same time, just watching it this time, I do see it. I love this movie, but it's still, the writing feels so much different in some aspects, feels a lot different than his other films, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's really the part that also feels very Tarantino is the Michael Parks part at the very beginning of the movie, which is one of the best intros, I will say, in a film, is just that whole convenience store scene. And you got Michael Parks' character coming in as the sheriff, talking to the guy. They have the back and forth conversation. It doesn't really feel like it's going anywhere other than the fact it's just a regular. This is what he does every day. He comes in, talks, and so on like that. And then you realize that, you know, both George Clooney and Tarantino, and that's one of my favorite parts, always makes me laugh at me. I love how Tarantino, because it's like the fact that he wrote the movie, like, he wrote himself in, like, who's his brother? George Clooney. so it makes it feel like George Clooney sort of got this weird, goofy, special ed brother.
Well, it kind of is, it's like his brother. George Clooney's brother is like Jeffrey Dahmer, basically. And he's just got to keep him in line, you know? It's because it's really... it's his brother, and his brother got him out. At the same time, it's his brother and he loves him, but it's like his brother is what's fucking everything up. If he went solo a long time ago and just left his brother out of it, he would probably be fine. Now, it does show Seth has like an anger streak and he can let his temper get the best of him, but overall, he is like the save the cat moment for Seth is him laying down rules of what he won't do. It's like, I don't want to, but I will kill everybody in this bar or in this gas station. And the thing is, he is a piece of shit. He is a bad person, but he has a very couple of strict rules, and he wants people to follow those rules so he doesn't have to do what he has to do. And that's kind of interesting. It's interesting that's what they use to endear you to Seth, of all things.
Yeah, well, where it's like Tarantino's character is the psychopath that, like, will do everything wrong because he's got no moral code, you know, and if it wasn't for his brother sort of, like, somewhat keeping him in check, God knows where he would be, you know? Because it's like, they make his character, like, almost one of those ones where it's also another strange role, I think, for, like, to be like, okay, you just got into sort of Hollywood. You're now, like, this And what's the first, like, what's the best character you want to play? You want to play the guy who just brutally murders people, rapes people, like, you know, like, even like, I think he mentions he rapes children or something like that. Like, George Clooney had a passing line like that. It's like, I think
did they mention that?
Something like
that. Oh, well, not, maybe not Juliette Lewis. He was into Juliette Lewis.
No, but this is before Juliette Lewis, because he did something before the movie. And it's just like, you think about, like, this is the character. I mean, I think Tarantino probably saw it, like, it'll be funny. You know, it's Tarantino, so he probably thinks that, like, playing this really dark, brutal character that's like a psychopath and just broken and everything like that. But there's that weird thing is, like, when somebody really doesn't know who you are, and this is probably the first time they see you really acting other than your small scene in Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, I think there's that thing where it's just like, dude, this guy's fucking weird. Like, who the hell is this? Oh, that's the guy that wrote the story. He wrote the story? So you mean, like, he literally wrote that scene in where Salma Hayek's just putting her foot in his mouth and pouring, like, you know, tequila down it? Yeah. Yeah, he wrote that in there.
You know what? I could see one of two things happening, because it's no secret. Anybody who's seen, like, two Tarantino movies, maybe other than Hateful Eight or Reservoir Dogs, anything other than that, it's blatantly obvious. But, like, yes, he has a foot fetish. He loves feet. He fucking loves feet. It's very obvious. Good for him. Whatever. Mm-hmm. That said, though, this one, it's just kind of like, okay, you... I wonder if he just, like, wrote that scene, like, yeah, after she dances with the snake, then she's going to, like, come in and, like, jam her foot in his mouth and pour, like, alcohol down, like, the leg. Like, hey, Quinn, we were wondering if you want a cameo in the movie. I know who I want to be! Like, you don't want to do a cameo? No! Like, I don't know. Or it's, like, one of those things, like, when the conversation he was going to be in the movie was coming up, then maybe he's like, can I write a scene in there? Can I just write a scene? Thank you. I'll be right back. You know?
Well, all I picture too is I picture, like, you know, Robert preparing, like, Salma Hayek and stuff like that. She's like, okay, cool. So I'm going to go out, put my foot in George Clooney's mouth. That'd be great. And then they're like, no. It's the other brother. not George.
Look, I have a fucking crazy phobia of snakes. It took me 2 months of therapy to prepare for this whole dance scene I have with a boa constrictor. After that, I got to jam my foot down Tarantino's mouth. Yeah.
And pour tequila down it, too.
Madonna wants the role if you don't want to do it. Like, does she? Probably.
All right. Yeah, she's willing to put her, you know, her whole foot down to her knee into his mouth. You know, what are you willing to do?
The reverse Muppet on him. Yeah.
because that's all like that's what I think about when I watch this movie. I just think of all those scenes that just go, like, you know, if you didn't know anything of it, you'd just be like, okay, whatever, playing a part, weird, you know. But when you know that's, like, that's the dude that wrote the thing, you're like, that means, you know, he wrote this stuff in for himself, because he probably had that bright idea that he was going to play this character from the beginning and everything like that, you know. And I just love, once again, having himself as George Clooney. I mean, like, literally, like, how many other people could you, like, tie yourself to as, like, you know, the, you know, People Magazine's most beautiful man of the year? You know, it's like, that's like making yourself, like, I want to be Brad Pitt's brother.
Well, it's also the soul patch doesn't help. The soul patch and, like, the Beatles haircut and, like, kind of slouching with the Coke bottle glasses. Like, he probably was trying to make himself look as, like, schlubby and unlikable and unfuckable as possible. But that's something about this movie. Just, we'll get back to, I guess, like, the other aspects of it. Like, when I was saying, like, some of the aspects of the dialogue don't always feel as Tarantino-ish. I feel like something this movie does do is it goes out of its way to add in character. Or I mean, you could find a lot of horror movies, a lot of, like, schlocky horror films with a lot of character and a lot of passion. But at the same time, I feel like this one, in ways you wouldn't initially expect a movie of its type to have. Like, the idea, like, Harvey Keitel is not only, like, a priest, he's a former priest. He lost his faith in God. And I feel like a lot of times whenever they do that in, like, a movie, they either make, like, the religious family, like, because, you know, his daughter, I guess he had two different wives at some point. His daughter's Juliette Lewis, and the boy, I forgot his name, the kid, Ernest Liu. Yeah, Ernest Liu. He, like, his mom died, And it's the thing is, like, first off, that's already kind of like, you're not expecting that dynamic of family. You're not expecting, like, did you guys, like, you, like, wait, Julia Lewis and like so she was married to someone before and then something happened there, but then you got married to this kid's mom and then she dies. Just this that little extra of, like, you know, which is something you see in real life, but not a lot of movies. And then the other aspect of, like, I feel like whenever they write Christian characters in movies, they're either one of two things. They're either too good or too, like, hypocritical. And this, they're very, like, real people.
Yeah, no, and that's what I think too, where it's like, you know, with Harvey Keitel's character, that actually kind of makes sense, because, you know, like, see, like, it doesn't really go 100% specific on what he could be, because it's like that thing that, like, so many, you know, Christian people always either adopt and or have, like, foreign exchange students and or, you know, there's all that kind of stuff that can kind of go in there too, you know, because it never goes into high detail other than the fact that George Clooney's just questioning it, you know, way forward and everything.
I think they show a picture of the mom, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they did adopt them or something.
Yeah, I just say it could go multiple ways. It's more.
Yeah. And it just that family, because, you know, even the kids kind of swear in front of him and he's not like, hey, Jesus wouldn't like that. He's very, like, he's very cool dad. He's very cool dad. No nonsense, no bullshit dad. But at the same time, he's also got a spine at the same. You see, he really loves his kids, and, you know, he's just a very likable guy. And the kids, I mean, both Julia Lewis and Ernest Lou. They're both good, but character wise, they're both just kind of there. They're just kind of there, but they are kind of like moral weight, I guess, to add, and kind of stakes to keep the movie going in that direction. But Reggie, actually, I'm gonna go back to one quick little thing at the beginning. So for the opening shootout at the gas station in this film, that part, I want to say, it's like, because that character, Earl McGraw, which is played by Michael Parks, which Earl McGraw is a character that pops up in other Tarantino films.
Mm-hmm.
And some Robert Rodriguez movies. He's in characters in Planet Terror, that character's in Kill Bill Volume 1, and he's in Death Proof. And the whole, like, Tarantino lore thing is his movies that seem like they could be a little bit more realistic, those are meant to be kind of like real world things. So say, like, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Jackie Brown, that's meant to be real world.
Mm-hmm.
Where, say, something like Kill Bill or Django Unchained or From Dusk Till Dawn, those are more meant to be, oh, those are those crazy over the top movies the people in Pulp Fiction watch. Those are those weird, like, Fox Force 5 would be something in the realm of Kill Bill. So Earl McGraw is just a character from that, and that has me thinking, fucking poor Earl McGraw. He, like, survived the zombie apocalypse somehow through Planet Terror, because if he's alive by the end of Planet Terror, that means they must have somehow reversed the zombie apocalypse thing or whatever. He had to survive all that, come back to El Paso just to get shot in the back of the head from a fucking sex offender.
Yeah, exactly. That's just how it goes, you know. And who knows if, like, they thought that out all the way thoroughly on there.
So a lot of thought. They probably just liked Michael Parks, really.
Yeah, they probably just said that thing where, like, you know, like when you have a character, it's like a really great character, and you know the scene's written how it is, but then when you see it, like, once it's all said and done, you're like, damn, why did we kill that character off? That thing was amazing. Like, we should have had him, like, in the movie the whole time. I mean, that was the Kevin Smith thing, is that they're like, man, Michael Parker's so good, and, like, he's always just has these bit roles. I want to give him, like, a full seat, you know, the whole movie, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, because he does just kind of steal the show, and it's so sad, because for a minute, like, he could leave this movie if he really wanted to, as you're watching it, because he's such a good character. And even like, the small details of, like, the guy who running the liquor store, he seems pretty cool too. He seems likable, and he's trying to keep things calm, but he's also not a pushover. When he gets shot, he does, like, the thing you expect a Texan to do. He goes into his safe and gets out his gun and, like, starts firing at them immediately. And I feel bad for him, because you want Seth to get out of there, because you want the story to continue, but at the same time, you feel bad for Benny, or whatever his name is, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and they just get in this massive, awesome convenience store shootout that just to top it all off at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, I like the part where, like, George Clooney tells Tarantino, he's like, start shooting the liquor and stuff like that. So he starts shooting all the balls behind him, which already looks really cool. And George Clooney, like, takes that, like, toilet paper and turns it into, like, a flaming Molotov and chucks it over and lights the guy on fire. And when you think the guy's dead, he's not. He pops back up again on fire, still firing off the last bit of rounds he has, where, you know, it ends in like a total, like, you know, in a sense, Tarantino, like, unload the clip onto him.
Yeah, no, that's like one of the coolest openings for a movie. And it's also the smaller details, kind of like some of I didn't watch it in preparation for the show. I wish I kind of, I was a long time. I was actually, earlier last week or week before, when I was talking about watching Fright Night, I forgot to bring Fright Night with me. I thought I brought From Dusk Till Dawn with me. I grabbed From Dusk Till Dawn disc one. I forgot. Oh yeah, that's some stupid fucking, I mean, no, it's not stupid, it's informative, but it's just a fucking long ass documentary called Phil Tilt Boogie on the making of the film. I'm like, why would you make that disc one? Why would you make that disc one? That's the one I brought with me in this. Okay, whatever. I have to rent this thing now. So I don't have all the details about the movie. Like, I should have probably watched
it. It was on HBO, but
I didn't see it on it wasn't over here, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, I didn't get the licensing.
But it's one of those things where you watch this and it's what was I going to say? I remember years ago, I listened to the audio commentary and Tarantino said, like, at one point the studio, so they have like the lady in the back of the car at the beginning of the movie that they're taking as their hostage, the bank teller. And I think that was one of Tarantino's acting teachers at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And weird way to repair. And they said originally the studio was pushing for it to be some hot young bombshell. But he says, like, well, the reason we went with her, like, someone with more of a mom look, because you immediately get more kind of scared for her. I mean, you'd be scared for, like, you know, if she was a bombshell or whatever. But I think people see some middle-aged lady in this situation, they can't help but think of someone like their mom or their aunt or someone they know from work, you know? So I was like, and because every time I watch this movie, it's kind of like a little bit like the end of Departed. Like, maybe Leo's going to make it out of the elevator this time. Or maybe Reggie's not going to become a crazy fucking asshole and just do something off screen, you know?
Well, that's also one of the coolest, like, ways that scene is, where, like, you know, they're in the motel room and whatnot, and George Clooney's like, yo, you be calm here, I'm gonna be back in like a couple hours, scout everything out. And then when he comes back and he finds that, you know, he's like, Reggie, what the fuck did you do? And he's looking in the room and it just shows George Clooney's face, and it's like slowly zooming in on him as he's kind of taking it all in, and it shows like split second scenes of like the terror and carnage that just like unfolded here, blood, guts, and all kinds of stuff. And I remember back in the day, I pause it and like slow go through, because like the frames go by so fast, but it's such a kind of a neat way to sort of go through it, where like you see all this, but you see it just for a split second, and it's almost like you still just see George Clooney's face, like taking it all in, like, dude, what the hell is wrong with my brother?
Well, he has that slow zooming because every so often it seems like he kind of has this thing where he's able to talk himself into, he's my brother, I gotta look out for him, he's my little brother, he's a little fucked, but I know deep down there's something there. And then he has these moments where he's like, oh shit, this is why my life is so fucked. This is why, you know, it's probably him defending his brother, which kind of led up down like a path of this kind of shit, always defending his brother, always making things go from bad to worse. That's my assumption. So, in that scene, cause like, you know, the music's all ominous, like this low tone, and like Seth, like, it's just like Reggie, because we see Seth has a high tolerance for death and killing, but even he has standing there this look like, I need an explanation right now. And Reggie's like, yeah, so she was just acting crazy. She totally changed when you left. Like, how'd she change? Oh, well, she started saying all, you know, just like, you could just totally see, like, oh, you're just a fucking crazy asshole who doesn't know what the fuck's going on, really.
Yeah, it's that one that, George Clooney's character, he has no problem killing, but he's got to almost have more reason to kill, where Quentin Tarantino's, on the other hand, he'll just do all the heinous activities that he just does because he's messed up and doesn't, you know, almost doesn't see reality in the normal way.
We'll keep it to the movie for the most part, but did you ever watch the From Dusk Till Dawn show by chance?
I saw a couple episodes. I saw like the beginning couple episodes of it, where it was kind of just sort of like a remake of it. And then I know it kind of goes farther and deeper into it. I remember it being kind of decent.
First season was good. I mean, I only got like maybe two episodes into the second season that I dropped off it. Not that it was bad. I just kind of like, it just takes the movie and extends it out to a show, kind of like what a lot of shows were doing back in like 2014, 2015. We were taking classic movies and just making shows out of them, you know, like Fargo and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because what they, it's interesting because some of those characters, they kind of give more like, I forget her name, but the Samuel Hyatt character is more of a character in the show. She's like a long running, she's like one of the main characters in the show. Mm-hmm. Reggie also, is that his Tarantino's character's name, Reggie, or is it something else?
Richie.
Richie, it's also implied, they try to do this thing where they kind of give a little, they try to make you have, give a little bit more sympathy to Richie because he's crazy, but he's not like, he's not as fucking crazy. He's not like as much of like, he's not like raping people, but he is like a killer. But the thing is, he has these visions or something that he can't, he has like, he's like, he's got the shine or some shit like that. They don't call it the shine, but basically it's something like that. So when he kills her, it's because he has some kind of vision that's making him kill her.
So they do that tone it down for TV thing. That's what it sounds kind of, like.
Well, it sounds like, well, yeah, they, well, I mean, he still kills her. He kills her violently. He pulls her eyes out or something. But it's like they take away some of the responsibility on him. Like, I don't know, something happens where like he's having a vision, he's freaking out in front of her, and then she pulls a gun. They're having a moment. Then she pulls a gun on him and the gun's empty. And then he realizes that she's trying to pull a gun on him. He's like, no, no. And he just goes and grab a knife and turns around. He's like, no, they don't show it, that kind of thing. And then something similar. Like, there's still a lot of violence. I mean, the show was good, but it was like, at the same time, I didn't feel the need to check out the second season, but the first season was good. It just kind of expanded on everything, you know?
Yeah, it's that weird one that, like, it's like without like the original kind of cast, it's like it kind of feels like, yeah, it's, I know Robert Rodriguez is still involved in it, which, I mean, that was kind of the interesting thing about it, but it does feel like that one, like, I would rather almost just see a sequel that had George Clooney in it, in a sense. That would be the ideal, like, circumstances. What happens to him when he decides to go to El Rey and we can finally get that getaway ending that never appears in any of them?
That's in season two, but like I said, I stopped early on. Oh. Like, they all go different directions. Yeah.
Oh, maybe but it's not George Clooney. I guess that's the thing. Is it's like, it would be more interesting if that's what it was. Was like, let's have an actual like sequel. You know, I know there's like the From Dusk Till Dawn 2 and 3, but those ones are more just like, here's like other stories that Tarantino and, you know, Robert Rodriguez decided to produce. They're like, yeah, I could use some extra cash coming in. I figured it out. Robert Patrick will find a way.
Oh, well, here's something for the people might find interesting. If they don't already know this, so earlier I made the Sam Peckinpah reference, and there is some blatant Sam Peckinpah references in here. Now, in the book, The Getaway, which Sam Peckinpah made the movie to.
Yeah, Jim Thompson's book.
Yeah, the movie cuts off before they get to this point. Like, they just get away, like, they got away in The Getaway. Good for them. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know? Where in the book, what happens is they go to this place called El Rey, which is meant to be this like, you actually have the book.
I bought the book a little while ago. I was like, you know what? I want to have that book. As much as we always talk about The Getaway and everything like that. And this one had a cool cover. This is like an 80s version, actually. It's not like an original one, but I'm like, I literally bought the one on eBay. I'm like, wait, which one has the coolest cover? I'm like, because of course the modern one's like kind of boring. It's just got like a car on the front or something like that. Like, I love those old school.
Is he wearing like a sailor's hat?
Yeah, he looks like Humphrey Bogart in this. So
he looks like just like one of those, like, you know, like flamboyant, like trust fund guys that always be wearing like a bathrobe and a sailor's hat, like a long cigarette in a party. Like, let me tell you. And then the second like shit gets bad, he goes like, I'm going to get my gun.
Yeah, you know. Looks like he should be hanging out like the Playboy Ranch.
He's second one of the older brothers who's on like the rowing team comes out, gets him in a headlock. He starts fucking going to get the gun, you know?
Yeah.
Accidentally shoots a lady, like, just, oh, throw her in the fucking, we, don't worry, there's a spot in the back.
So, yeah, our Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw right there.
I just want to know, now I want to read it, because I want to know why the fuck, there's no part where they get away in a boat. So now I want to know why the fuck he's wearing a sailor's hat. So now I got to read the book.
Well, the nice thing, but, too, is it's an under 200-page book, so it's like you could read it practically in, like, you know, a sitting or two. It's not like one of those ones where it's like, here's 800 pages just to get the LRA.
maybe that's where the boat, maybe that's where the hat comes in. But anyway, so.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not too sure.
There's a place called El Rey, which is meant to be like a haven, a safe place for criminals. But the thing about El Rey is once you go there, you're stuck there. You can't go anywhere else. And it's kind of like the special walled off city. And you pay a fee to get in there. You get in there. But the thing is, all a twist in the book. And I didn't read the book. I just read the cliff notes when we were comparing it to the movie. The thing that happens is once you get in there, everything passes a certain point. Like, eventually you run out of money. And once you run out of money, you go into this section that's kind of just walled off from everything else, and you're just left to survive. So everyone's just killing each other over whatever and just trying to survive. So, and even resorting to cannibalism in some aspects, which we don't see, but it's acknowledged and said. So this whole, like, what the fuck thing happens, it's like the last two chapters of the book where we think they're all good, this gets dropped in. And in this movie, that's where George Clooney and Tarantino are trying to get to. That's their safe place. But at the same time, now we know, like Tarantino knew, like, this is meant to be kind of like a death sentence for him either way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the book ends on this note, the movie does not, though. So, as the writer, it's meant to be imply that's the reason he shoos Juliette Lewis away, because he knows he's a dead man. She's got her whole life ahead of her. They're just trying to go somewhere where they'll be safe and live out their final days. Granted, by the end, of course, it's just him. Spoilers before we get to the end, but yeah.
Yeah, well, it's like that one that, like, I know that, like, even Sam Peckinpah, like, he was like, I don't want Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw to have to eat each other at the very end of the, like, the movie. Like, that wasn't going to be the happiest one.
Did he say that?
Yeah, because that's what, it goes in, like, such a bummer kind of ending, but it's like, I always want to see that. And then even there's the remake of The Getaway, too, that's got, what's his face in it?
Alec Baldwin, I think.
Yeah, Alec Baldwin, and it still doesn't have that ending in there. But then again, that feels like that'd be a hard one to do. Just do a made-for-TV movie in 93 and then try to throw that ending in as a curveball.
Well, I think it's also one of those things where it doesn't happen at the end, but they agree to it that, like, they're trying to screw each other over to, like, inherit the other's money so they could last longer, as long as possible, before going to, like, the dead zone or whatever. And they come together like, well, we came here as a couple, we'll die as a couple, whenever it happens we'll face it. They just kind of like, all right, so that awaits us one day.
Yeah, and then it's like that's it, you know.
There is no getaway from death, that kind of thing.
That doom and gloom. But I think it's just interesting how in From Dusk Till Dawn that, like, that is where they're getting to, and that's the place, though it once again still doesn't show it.
Yeah.
It's just that mystery of, like, it's never going to be seen. I mean, obviously maybe the TV show goes there, but that's not the same thing.
I didn't see. I don't remember if they did show it. I don't remember it. But yeah, like, oh, it's just a CVS in, like, an apartment complex right next to it. It's like the most underwhelming thing possible.
Well, really, what it sounds like is it's got that sound like it's like a cruise line that you get on. You're like, man, we're going down to Mexico for like $400. I can't believe I got this for a week. And then, like, when they get on there, like, all the prices are jacked really high and everything like that. You're like, oh fuck. This is where they're getting us at.
Yeah.
You know, one of those kind of things. But also in the movie, you know, the fun thing we never really talked about, ironically, this whole time, is really Robert Rodriguez, because, you know, that's only like the other ginormous part of this thing. And this is that interesting thing, because Robert Rodriguez, it's like he makes El Mariachi, you know, and then it's like, hey, Robert, that movie was great. You want to make some more things? And like in 1 year, he's like, fuck yeah, do I? He makes 4 films in one single year, like a maniac, you know, to top it off, not just, you know, directing them, but, you know, writing stuff, you know, doing cinematography, doing music, doing all kinds of editing and all that stuff there, because he's got right after El Mariachi. I don't remember exactly in what specific order these all come. He's got Road Racers, which I think is the second one. And then he's got, of course, Desperado from Dusk Till Dawn. And then he's got Four Rooms, which granted, he's just directing a part of it, but he definitely does the extremely best part of that Four Room segment. Better than Tarantino's part, definitely better than the other two guys' parts.
This came out before The Faculty?
Yes, because I think Faculties comes right after this movie. That's like 97, and this is 96 from Dusk Till Dawn.
So this like, really is like early on in both their... I mean, I knew it was early on in both their careers, but very early on in both their careers then. So this is like before Jackie Brown, before... Shit, all right, yeah.
Well, and then the other thing too, speaking of even Tarantino-wise, I want to say that this script, which also might make it why it sort of seems a little bit kind of different feeling, I think it's like it's before Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. Because I want to say that he had True Romance as his first script, then Natural Born Killers, and I want to say From Dusk Till Dawn is the third one that he wrote. Then he wrote Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, you know. So okay. It does kind of make sense. And you can also say that technically Pulp Fiction has what's his name? Robert... Who's the other writer of Pulp Fiction? The guy who, like,
Robert,
nobody ever really...
Robert something. I forgot his name, too.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Everybody always kind of forgets that guy, exactly, and so on. Where this one's just singular Tarantino writing without, you know... I'm not saying that, you know, of course, probably Robert Rodriguez threw in some ideas, of course, you know, and like anything else, you know. Sometimes credits don't always mean that that's the only sole person that, you know, touched the script, But I think it's one of those ones, like, I love just the combo of having all those guys on there and just, you know, Robert coming in, just being like, he's got like keys to like the kingdom. So he's going to use them to like full mastery. He's like, I'm going to make as many movies as possible because they might kick me out anytime soon.
Yeah, I think maybe that, I got to make this before this imposter. Like, I think maybe, I mean, I'm not saying that because he is very talented, of course, but like. Maybe that they have that case of imposter syndrome. Like, gotta get this done as quick as possible before like this whole like young up and coming Hollywood director thing goes away. Like, we gave like your vision, get the fuck out. You know, it's like just at that point of like, is maybe just treating almost kind of like gold pan season almost. Just try to get as much done as you can before the studio execs lose too much money on a couple of movies that didn't pan out.
Yeah, well, you can kind of see that's why Robert Rodriguez quickly learned to jump ship from Hollywood and do his own thing in Texas and have his own company and have his... I mean, even this movie, I think, was still shot with non-union crews, which Robert Rodriguez generally likes to always go with. I think he just likes to be not tied to the system, not tied to the man. You know, he likes to have that freedom and stuff like that. Literally rage against the machine and do his own thing, which kind of does give him that control that... I guess you never have to listen to like what somebody else, you know, has to say, or you're not indicted to anything.
Well, he also, yeah. So, cause he does it out of Austin, Texas, and he does usually just a lot of times he kind of said, unless he's doing like, I think if it's one of his own movies, well, we'll get back to From Dusk Till Dawn proper in a second, but it's one of those things where he, if it's his own movie, he's writing and directing, then I think he basically just like, He does it out of Austin, does look in front of a green screen. He kind of creates the setting around him to make it. That's how he made Pulp Fiction. Not Pulp Fiction. That's how he made Sin City.
Here's something. City. You guys didn't know this, but actually Robert Rodriguez is the guy who made Pulp Fiction. What did Tarantino do? Well, actually, he just played that one role, and that was it, and took credit for it. Huh. Weird story.
Yeah, no, he... No, like... Yeah, that's actually Danny Trejo. It wasn't John Travolta. It was Danny Trejo, like, trying to get that suitcase the whole time, and you know.
And people don't realize that it was all CG.
He's just that good. He was ahead of the curve there. No, because he usually, a lot of his movies were in front of green screens, like all the Spy Kids movies and all his kids movies, all that kind of shit. And then as time went on, though, I think he would just take like a Hollywood gig just as like a director on hire, for instance. Like, he did Alita. He has that movie coming out, which I have not seen. Maybe it's already out, but
it's on Peacock, I think,
or whatever.
I saw it pop up on there.
I'm curious to check it out. I mean, the only thing that has me curious is it's his name attached to it, but beyond that, it doesn't look like a movie that's crazy to see, but I'll check it out, you know. So I think he's just somebody who's kind of director for hire here and there. But when he does his own thing, he just likes to do it out of his ranch on like a green screen. So kind of George Lucasing it to a certain extent.
Well, that's literally where he learned that stuff was, because George came up and told him, he's like, oh, Robert, you know what you need to do is you just need to get yourself a green screen and a digital camera, because then you do less work and then you can literally sit down and you don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's my dream's been to pretty much, you know how the editing room's amazing? Like, it's like the best place on earth. Like, you literally, if you put a mini fridge in there, you realize that why go anywhere else? Because you have the mini fridge and you have the editing thing, you know? And it's like young Indiana Jones. I realize that the easiest thing to do is I write a script or I write a treatment. I give it out to somebody. They write the full script. I send them clear across the world. They shoot my vision. They send me files back every single night. I edit them together on this Pixar computer that I spent like $10 billion on. And it's, you know, I'm testing it out. And I put these things together on the fly. I call them in and say, hey, I want this shot here of young Indy doing this or that. They do it. I don't have to leave the chair. I'm still in the chair. I go to the mini fridge. They got Diet Coke in there because somebody puts it in there, not me. And life's great.
I don't know who. It just appears. I don't see when I enter the room. It just comes. It just appears.
So, Robert, that's what you got to do.
I jerk off and go to sleep in the chair.
When I learned that's how, like, that's like, that was like the way, like, that seems like the most, like, I want to make movies, but I don't want to leave my chair.
It's an easy,
you guys fly
too.
Across the world, go shoot things on, like, you know, the Great Wall of China, where the, you know, there's going to be insects and the sun and all sorts of things I don't want to be involved in, and actors and all that stuff. And then I'll just put pieces together as you keep shooting it.
Yeah, just yeah, there's insects, the sun. You'd say, George, people. Yeah, yes, George, there's people outside. I fucking hate people. We know, George, we know.
You know, be better than people is if everything was just a hot rod, but no people in them. You know, like a transformer, I guess. I guess that's what I'm getting at. Can I be a transformer? Can I be the yellow coupe from American Graffiti and I just transform into Ultra George?
Actually, fine. I'll transform into an easy boy. I'll transform into a chair.
If I was a chair, I would always be sitting. Oh, wait. Does that mean someone would be sitting on me? Well, I don't know if I like this anymore. That involves people again.
What if I do? Yeah. So, from dusk till dawn.
But yeah, and that is, if we get even farther, the cameos keep happening and all kinds of stuff, because then we also get Tom Savini in here, you know.
Tom Savini, sex machine, yeah.
Yeah, you get him.
Busey Brothers played him in the show, not to go back to that, but yeah.
Who does what now?
One of the Buseys played him in the show.
Is it Jake Busey?
Maybe it was Jake Busey. It wasn't the Busey, but it was a Busey. Maybe Jake Busey.
I do like Jake Busey. You know, he's in Starship Troopers. He's the terrorist in Contact. You know, you see Jake all the time.
There's a face. You're just like, that's a Busey. I don't need to look it up. I don't know which one it is, but it's a Busey. That's all I can say.
You know, it's one of those ones. But yeah, that's when you also get Danny Trejo. With Danny Trejo of short hair, I forgot about that part, too. It's like, oh, yeah, and he's got a little mustache. It's not even like the...
Well, Danny Trejo is one of those dudes, like, you think, like, he's never aged. And then, like, this is the first week I've seen him in a while. I'm like, oh, wait, no, he's aged. And he still looks, I mean, he still looks fucking awesome. He still looks like a badass. But, like, seeing, like, short-haired, short-mustache Danny Trejo was like, oh, he does. I forgot that this is in his final form.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, yeah, that threw me off, too. I was like, oh, yeah, he actually looks quite young in this by now. Like, because you're just so used to old Trejo by this point and the way he's going to look for it. It's weird because it's like, I thought he had long hair in Desperado, but maybe he cut it for, I don't know if he.
It's been a minute since I watched Desperado.
Yeah, that's the same thing, too, because even this movie, I probably hadn't seen this movie in, like, it feels like 15 years. It's like, it's that one where it's been a while since I've seen a handful of some of these, you know, old movies that you used to watch all the time. And then, you know, there's just so many movies in life. You can only watch so many things. And the next thing you know, it's been a while. And it's like, oh, wow.
This is one of those movies I'd probably watch, maybe like just put it on I'd watch it a lot and then maybe put it on the background or something. It's been like, yeah, a good 10 years since I've even watched this thing. And, yeah. And like, you also had, You had the Busey and you had Cheech Marin playing multiple characters, which is kind of meant to be like a reference to what they did in like a lot of whatchamacallit, and to a lot of spaghetti westerns where they would have the same actor playing a different character, like in the sequel or something.
Yeah, exactly. So you got him there. You also had Fred Williamson who's kind of like one of those like total like Tarantino guys who's like in all kinds of stuff. He's in a lot of black exploitations from back in the day. So it makes he definitely has that feel like, oh, you can see where Tarantino cherry picked him out to have him in the movie. And he survived for quite a while, like in that final like bar scene when there's only about like six or seven of the people left.
Well, the thing about this movie, because it goes for a while, I guess we never really said, we're talking as if people listening to this have already saw the movie. So for people who, for just to clarify, an hour in, if you're still listening, you never seen this movie, what ends up happening is they're on the run from the Gecko brothers are on the run, George Clooney and Tarantino.
And a big old heist or something, isn't it?
Yeah. I think he got, like, Richie got Seth out in the middle of like a court hearing or something like that, and they're on the run that way. I think it was something to that effect. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, and then there is a bank heist because Michael Parks talks about that at the beginning and so on. And then there's that part where there's that lady on TV who feels like she's way too like in love with her
exposition.
Job. Yeah, well, she's that, but she just feels like murder, and that's, you know, seven body count here and 10 officers, and it's fantastic. Look at my, you know, lashes.
She's like edging, basically. You're like rubbing her legs together as she's saying this.
Well, like she loves that part where she gets to announce all the deaths of the night.
Maybe it's a little kind of like early version of whatchamacallit, of Natural Born Killers, kind of like how the media just loves sensationalize it and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Maybe it's trying to pull something from that. But yeah, that's right, because they need the money to get to El Rey. So he broke them out, they did the bank robbery, and then off to El Rey. That's what it was. But anyway, but then they realize, okay, you just killed one of our hostage because you just freaked out or whatever the fuck. So now we got to figure out how to get across. And then Harvey Keitel and his family, which is Juliette Lewis and Ernest Liu, are his kids, and they're staying at the same motel, and they're in this big RV. I'm like, we can sneak into that RV and get them, basically kidnap them and make them take us across take us across the border, and that's something we can hide out in. So then there's like maybe like a 15 minute period where they're just kind of like hanging out in the RV, and they get to this bar where they're supposed to just wait from dusk till dawn, basically, for their contact come meet them. And then suddenly, you know, it just seems like a crazy rowdy biker bar. But then, surprise for people who've never seen the movie before and never looked at the poster, it's actually filled with vampires. They're not like, well, they start off as sexy vampires. At least one of them does. Or a couple, actually, no, a good handful of them start off as sexy vampires. Because Samuel Hayek's not the only one there. That's right. So it's basically a strip club / biker bar. And then once shit starts going down, because, you know, some like Seth does something, Richie does something, and the fight breaks out, and then doors close, and then all the vampires turn unsexy and shit gets violent.
Yeah, you know what? That's the weirdest thing is I was thinking about, like, which when you're kind of leading in there is when they all stop at the motel earlier on and Harvey Keitel has this thing where he's just like, I just want to sleep in a real bed. It's like, dude, you're driving a bed around all day long. It's just not a good enough bed. Like, I bet you that hotel bed's not going to be nearly as good as your motorhome bed. Like, I know you think it might be. I don't know why. He's just like, I just want to have space, I guess. That's what I like. I like space. If I want to bounce a ball off the wall, I can't do that in the motorhome. It comes back and hits me right in the face. There's not enough reaction time. I'm getting old, you know. But and it's my wall. I don't want to damage my wall. But, you know, if it's their wall, I don't care. That's what I want to do.
And he's just like, you know, I just I we just need Act Two to start. We just need Act Two to start somehow. So
yeah,
kids, the motel.
The motel. Juliette Lewis, there's no pool. I'm not paying extra for that. I know that you think that you can judge a hotel by a pool, but that's not always the case. You know, Dad doesn't do that. When he sees a pool, he just knows he's got to pay $60 more. And you know what? He's not going to use it because I don't want to be out there. I don't know who cleaned that pool.
Doesn't she, like, they find a pool somehow.
Oh, yeah, she does find a pool. Because she makes the thing like, I'm not getting out of this motorhome unless there's a pool there, Dad.
Yeah, that thing. Yeah. And we've already had that moment where, like, okay, he's like a priest who's our former priest struggling with his faith because his wife died in the crash. And at that point, they're taken in hostage by the family. And you see, Seth is a lot more like on top of Richie. He's a lot more of like, Richie, play nice. There's even a few points where he's just like, I don't want nobody starting any shit. And Richie, I'm talking to you mostly, you know? So he's kind of like more on top of it. And it's like, he doesn't really give a shit with the family, but he doesn't want to kill him because it's just more work for him. And he just kind of wants things to happen. But by the end of this, you see him getting kind of closer to him in some way, you know? And like, make no bones about it. Seth is not a good guy. And the movie lets you know right off the bat, Seth is not a good guy. But he at least has, like, his code.
Yeah, and he's got the George Clooney charm to go along with it and so on like that. But yeah. I mean, Harvey Keitel's just like, you know what? My wife died. Kids, you're getting out of school. We're going to drive across the U.S. in a motorhome. Dad, you sure you want someone to get us out of school right now? Yeah, what's the worst that's going to happen when we go out there? You know what I mean? The open road. It'll be like Goof Troop. You ever see Goof Troop?
We're going to watch it tonight, actually. We got a Blockbuster card.
You know, the cool thing about a Blockbuster card is you can go anywhere around the world, so you don't have to just go to your local one.
Yeah, like slow zooming on Tarantino's face, on like Harvey Keitel's face as he's saying this. Yeah, holding up the card, looking into the camera.
But yeah, so they go on, you know, and then Tarantino just gets, you know, creepy on Juliette Lewis. And Juliette Lewis is one of those ones that's where it's like, you never really know what her age is like in these earlier movies, because she plays characters that are like, oh, she must be 15 in this movie. And then you see a movie that's like literally the same year and like, now she's 26, you know, because she's in the, you know, she's in California with Brad Pitt, where you got good old school, like hillbilly Brad Pitt, where he talks like drunk Batman, where like Juliette Lewis comes out and she's like, shows her like her boob and stuff. He's like, hey, put that titty away, damn it. And not for the neighbor to see. Get back in the trailer, woman.
How much later is California than this?
I think it's like 96 or 97. It's like literally right around this, the same time as this is shot. It's only like maybe a year off.
I'm going to guess she's like probably like 20. I mean, because she has one of those faces that's kind of hard to tell. Like how you dress her up and how like she acts, she could probably pull off like 18, or she could pull off like mid-20s. I'm going to guess she's probably like around like 22, 23, playing like somebody's supposed to be 17. That's my guess.
Well, that's what I mean. Is I know she is older, but like that's that thing. She was kind of that actress who could play like in the same years. She'll be like all of a sudden she's like a teenager in one movie. She's like a full grown adult in another. You know, I mean, once again, right around this exact same time period, she's in Natural Born Killers.
That's
so
right.
That sort of gives her like, she's kind of like in all like the spinoff like Tarantino movies.
I wonder if he just like Tarantino pulled her aside, like, tell me how much fucking Oliver Stone fucking sucks. You know, like, she's like, you were good, but I hate that fucking movie. Tell me about Oliver Stone. You know, I'm curious to know why he hates Oliver Stone. Is it because just strictly how he changed the script, or is it just like he just hates his movies or whatever?
I think he already kind of disliked him as a director. Every once in a while, people that really just dislike Oliver Stone. And I've never been able to figure out exactly what the hatred is. Sort of, it's like, I'm like, dude, it's like, what, you don't like Scarface or Conan the Barbarian, or you don't like, you know, Platoon? Like, I mean, like, I could go a long ways of this. He's made a lot of stuff in a wide variety. You don't like Rambo 2? You know what I mean? Like, there's so many of these, like, movies and so on. Like, maybe if it's, like, one of those ones, like, oh, I don't like his political type stuff. I think there's sometimes always those kind of ones. Like, well, that's only, like, one-fifth of his movies. You know, the rest of it's all other kinds of things.
He considers Scarface, Natural Born Killers, and Savages as kind of like a trilogy, is kind of like on violence in media or something like that. But I mean, it's like, well, that's not the best way to end that trilogy, I'm gonna tell you right now.
yeah, Savage, that's like the weakest Oliver Stone movie I've ever seen. But and I was so, I mean, that was also one of those ones I remember being hyped to go see it. It was like, oh, Oliver Stone doesn't really turn out bad movies, right? Oh, well, then he's got this one here.
They can't all be winners, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's one of those ones. It's he does change the script, and I literally for like years I have the Natural Born Killers Tarantino version of the script. I've always thought it'd be fun to do a podcast where we read that script and then watch the movie, because I love Natural Born Killers, the Oliver Stone version, and I can kind of see where it definitely does its own thing in there and the weirdness that it has and so on. I think that makes it kind of interesting in itself, you know, but I would like to sort of see how Tarantino's goes, if it, in a weird way, maybe it's, is it darker? I know it's obviously got to be more toned down. Probably doesn't have all like the Doors kind of feelings going on it with like the surrealness that sort of happens in that film. But it'd be interesting to read and see where that takes it.
We should do that at some point. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
But
it's something I've always,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, something I've always wanted to. And I remember in Tarantino's book, Cinema Speculation or whatever, Or is that what that new book's called? Whatever. He talks about when he was going through Rolling Thunder and how what's his name? The dude who wrote Taxi Driver.
I forgot his name too.
But I'm trying to blank out his name, right? But he makes all kinds of great stuff. But he did Rolling Thunder script, but the script gets so changed in the process of the movie coming out, and it's one of those ones where the movie's still great, but the script almost is like almost kind of becomes radically sort of different from it, and so on like that. And Tarantino even made that mention in his book. He's like, hey, and I understand like that why you'd be kind of pissed if somebody like changes your script all around in the movie and so on like that. He's like, I know that for a fact from Natural Born Killers, Oliver Stone. So it's like, well, those ones, and I have that script too, because I'm almost like, man, I'd like to almost, because that movie's amazing, and it'd be interesting to see what the difference is in the script and so on like that. I know that I'm drawing blank on that dude's name, Paul Schrader, because his movies, because even Taxi Driver is way more extreme in the script than it is in the movie. Like, they, like, you think it's the 70s, but like, this, like, no, they're still like, dude, you gotta tone this guy's, like, this guy's a maniac. Like, tone it back, Martin. Like, what are you doing? Like, you know, make it like an, you know, an easy watch film for the whole family. You know, and I think that's the same, like the same way that Rolling Thunder sort of was. Well, I think he was like one of those. I think he was like a Frank Miller, where he's just like, "No, damn it, this is how life is, and I'm writing it the way that it goddamn goes." Well, Frank, that's, you know, we got to sell RoboCop action figures, so I don't know if that's going to work in this script. I'm pretty sure he had that same thing that Frank Miller sort of had trying to do stuff, where he wanted to go as hard and as ballsy as possible and say things exactly how people say them in real life without, like, the glee and little, like, extra, like, you know, let's polish it. Just take those rough edges, sand them down a little bit so nobody pokes an eye out.
Well, his hatred for inner bureaucracy in Hollywood and all that would drive him to make Sin City. So there you go.
Yeah, he finally gets Robert and Tarantino to help him out for that. And then he gets courageous and thinks he can go do it on his own without the two of them.
He's like, hey, pump the brakes, pal. Come on, we're happy you got this guy's second win, but come on, baby steps, come on. You probably need some help here, let's not lie. Anyway, but yeah, when they get to that bar, and shit goes fucking crazy. I will say, well, first off, like, the whole scene with, like, Samuel Hayek, apparently... That's, I'm kind of curious to know why she wanted to do, because apparently Rodriguez offered the role to her and she wanted to do it. And then when she was unsure because of the snake scene, because apparently she has like a deathly fear of snakes. So she was in therapy for a while getting ready for that scene. And Robert Rodriguez would say, like, well, Madonna might be up for the role. He'd say that to her just to, like, you know, get her back into it. And the thing is, I'm like wondering, like, all right, we're wrong. You're fantastic in it, and she's fucking gorgeous. And that dance scene, that's probably one of the most memorable scenes out of any, like, horror film from the 90s. That said, if you have a deathly fear of snakes, why would you do this movie? Because that's basically all this role is. She comes out, she does, like, a dance with a snake, and then she goes and she, like, jams her foot in Tarantino's mouth that was probably just written in 15 minutes before they started shooting. and then after that, she gets put in makeup. She gets to bite the side of his neck. And then she's, like, goes back to human form for a second, and then she's killed.
And she turns into a vampire-looking snake, just to top it off.
Yeah. Well, that's also another thing, because a lot of the vampires in it, like a lot of them have, like, a reptilian thing going on. Like, they're still, like, satanic, but they're more of, like, this, like, reptilian, which I thought was kind of an interesting take on it. You know what I mean? They have multiple powers, but they have more of, like, a snake reptilian kind of look to them, at least at a certain point. Like, all the ones in the bar initially. Mm-hmm. And, like, that or bats. Like, bats or snakes, that's what they kind of, their faces kind of resemble. And she's really only in the movie, if you think about it, like, and that's all spread out, because, like, within the quarter, like, around 10 minutes, like, her screen time altogether is maybe like 5 minutes of that movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, if you're, why would you want to do the role if that's all? No, we're wrong. She's fucking fantastic. sick, but like, why would you want to do the role that badly if that's all you're fucking in it for, you know?
Yeah, it's Juliette Lewis is going to have more screen time than you.
Yeah, I mean, doing wrong. When people think of this movie,
what if Sam Hawk's like, you know what? I want Juliette Lewis's part. She could be the steak dancer. Like, I'll be in the motorhome. Chad?
Yeah. She's like, wait, what? Like, so you're like, you know, like, I'll be the 18-year-old girl. Like, well, I mean, you're 29 at this point in time. Yeah, and Juliette Lewis is like 22. Yeah, she is, but she doesn't, you know.
She's just like, here, take the snake, slaps it over.
Just throws it at her.
You can put your foot in Tarantino's mouth. He obviously wanted to do that earlier.
Yeah.
Sit in the motorhome staring at it. They got a couple of like pure close shots of both your feet.
Just chucks it at her and fucking attacks Juliette Lewis. Like,
just crushes her because it's just this ginormous python.
It's like biting the side of her head or something. Like, fuck. Like, handler over here. I'm just imagining, just because, like, I'm wrong. I mean, I think she's fantastic in the movie. I'm just understanding the motive. I mean, then again, maybe once you actually see what the movie is, because when people like talk about this movie, that's always on the cover or that's always referenced. So maybe it's this kind of like really iconic scene, even for a movie which at the time wasn't well respected, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it is a weird one because, yeah, it's just this little bit role that's, yeah, like,
it,
yeah,
it's
a standout out scene. It's weird to think of, like, even though, like, I feel like that was just more like a threat, but like, if that was Madonna instead doing that scene.
I mean, Madonna doing that scene, like, I'm remembering what she looked like in the 90s by that point. I mean, she's probably still.
She's in Four Rooms. Like, that's what I always, 'cause remember, she's in one of the scenes of Four Rooms. I don't think it's the Tarantino part. I think she's in the one of the other directors of that one.
Hmm.
I can't.
Yeah. I mean, I think Samuel Hayek was a good choice, and I'm glad she went through with it because it's fucking, she did a good job in the movie. But, like, at the same time, though, it's just one of those things where I'm just thinking, how do I put it? Like, Is your biggest fear in the world worth 5 minutes of screen time? But at the same time, you know, it all worked out in the end. But they actually make her more of a character in the show, though. She actually kind of hangs around once she's introduced. Like, they have some little subplot about, like, the, whatchamacallit, or like the cartel or whatever. The vampires are working with the cartel or some shit like that. And there's like a vampire council, all that kind of shit, you know. So, where in this, she's just kind of like, she's just implied to be the queen of the vampires, and they only have like one or two lines of dialogue about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's kind of interesting, the evolution of the vampires, because when they first come in, they just kind of have like, some of them kind of look like Lost Boy vampires, some of them look kind of like snake or reptilian like vampires, but then like, because those are vampires that had to change from people into monsters. But then the ones that come from outside that didn't have to like look pretty or look human enough to anybody, those things look just flat out like beastly pot-bellied things from hell, you know?
Well, it's cool because there's a lot of Evil Dead kind of ness going on with a lot of these creatures and special effects, and especially even in like the deleted scenes, because I kind of forgot. I flipped through those real quick. I was like, oh, yeah, because there's even more gore and violence and even like those kind of like Evil Dead, like gross out type like things going on, that because they had to tone this movie still down. That's the thing about this one, is this movie was definitely one of those ones where it was going to get the NC-17, you know, so that's why there's a lot of green blood and white kind of milky stuff, just the same way that Evil Dead and Army of Darkness kind of had to go, which always gives more of a gross, it's like not nearly as violent feeling, but it has a very more gross kind of feeling when you start having all the other random colors in there.
I get more grossed out by like white milky shit like busting on me than I do like fucking like blood, you know.
Well, it's like that scene where like Juliette Lewis just literally like that, like, that one like explodes all over her when she's behind the bar or whatnot. It's all the goopy, gross, green and white stuff.
All shit or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like that's where they had to tone things down, which is always the interesting thing. It's like, I always would like this. This is probably one of those other movies that like, it'd be interesting to see if you could take like a bunch of the extra footage and go like, make me the NC-17 version of it. I just would like to see like, because you know, with like so many of these movies, like how much stuff that like, even just smaller things, like, you know, like, carrying on just like longer shots of even like when the mate or like when the bank teller lady gets murdered in the beginning and so on, like that, you know, that probably way more stuff is filmed and put together than what you see by the time it has to be edited for, you know, dimension.
there's probably like a Rodriguez cut of this movie, I bet.
Yeah, because Robert Rodriguez reminds me of one of those kind of guys who would save all those cuts. You know, they're probably all sitting into like his mansion. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Or there's even like, even the way they like, a lot of the way they kill the vampires, because a lot of, for the first part of it, they're all the vampire slain. They're basically fighting a bunch of stripper vampires and a couple of biker vampires, really. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you got like Tom Savini, and you got like, what's his name? You got like Fred Williamson, like grabbing them and like just body slamming them onto like a table that like with the legs sticked up, so just like impaling them all, like that kind of shit. Like it gets kind of like create like funny. Like then like, what's that band? Was that Los Lobos or was that Tito? And who was that? Wasn't Los Lobos that did no. Was in the band? That was that dude's in Desperado. I forgot his name though.
Yeah, he's one of the other guys in there. Because I know it almost feels like that band like could be like, you know, like sort of an El Mariachi kind of like thing, but
they're like playing a guitar that's made out of like a human that's been dismembered.
Yeah, something like that, and so on like that.
But so there is a tongue-in-cheekness with it.
Yeah, and I like that, like, too, like, the band, like, once they all turn to vampires, the band, then they're all playing these, like, you know, like, body horror, like, instruments, like, you know, organs and stuff all stitched together.
Mm. Yeah, like, I'll be honest, at that point, the movie's, it's not scary at that point. I mean, I guess in that, and there is a very obvious, like, assault on Precinct 13, so much so that the Ernest Liu character is wearing, a Precinct 13 t-shirt throughout the movie, and then, which you no, that's got to be a cool priest dad. Cool priest dad lets their son wears like Precinct 13 shirts. Just saying.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that part where you just think like, we just got to get out of here. But there's even more vampires outside. So it becomes like, okay. So they kind of come at him in waves and just them working together. And like Tom Savini, of course, has like, there's no way this movie doesn't become like kind of like partially a comedy when you have Tom Savini with like a fucking cock gun.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is this movie, it sounds kind of weird. Like it's a movie, it's got horror elements and so on like it, but it's really more like in that Army of Darkness category. Like, I don't think it's not a scary movie or anything like that. And it's more like it's a gangster movie first and foremost, you know, a crime like action flick. And then it becomes sort of an action horror at the end of the day. You know, that's definitely more what it is.
Is more Army of Darkness than Evil Dead 1.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and yeah, it just becomes, yeah, that's true. The Assault in Precinct 13, just a survival. We got to make it through till the end of the night and so on like that, you know. And the characters start getting, you know, bit and dying off one by one. Tom Savini gets bit in the arm, covers it up with a jacket. Nobody knows. And then later on, once he starts turning and everything like that, then they got to start killing each other and whatnot. And they just wreck havoc till pretty much we get to the point where the only people left is George Clooney and Juliette Lewis.
I did think it was kind of like, maybe it was meant to be intentional, kind of like a throwback to something you would see like in some of these movies. It's obviously like late 70s, early 80s, like horror grindhouse films you'd see back then. But the part when they stop for a minute and try to collect their thoughts and figure out how to do this. And then like Fred Williamson starts having Nam flashbacks. He's like talking about like, I remember this time in Nam where I got one in a headlock and I was start to stabbing him. We're just seeing him doing that. And then it's like right when Tom Savini is realizing he is like becoming a vampire. And then it cuts to like what he sees. And he just sees like four people standing there watching like Fred Williamson do his one man show, then just punching the air and like pretending to headlock somebody, and then cuts back to him like, oh my hand, oh my other hand, ooh, you know, putting around like that, and looks back and like back to like his one man show, just like you think that it, and I get that they're trying to get the point across, but at the same time they're just like, all right, that's, you're working through it, that's great, let's plan on something right now. Or maybe they're afraid that if they cut him off now, he's like, Charlie, he just comes at him. I don't know.
Yeah, they're like, he's telling a Nam story. It's best you don't break it up, you know. Nam stories don't have a pause button.
Yeah. And that's when Tom Savini like sneaks up behind him and bites his neck. And I think that they don't go into it, but I think there's something like, just going off what they do, is I think if you get bit in the neck, you become a vampire a lot quicker. Or if you get bit on the arm or the leg or something, it takes longer to process. They don't say that, but just going off like how the levels of different people change. I think that's how it goes.
Yeah, I kind of think so too. It sort of has that there, because when, you know, Harvey Keitel gets bit in the arm or whatever, he's like, I probably got like an hour, you know, unlike Fred Williamson or whatever, who had like, you know, or Williamson didn't have, you know, any of that time.
His face turned like a bat, like immediately.
Yeah, where Harvey Keitel lasts a little bit longer and so on like that, because, you know, but yeah, and then they sort of all get trapped in a back bunker where they find, they're like, oh shit, they've been taking all these, like, you know, truckers and, you know, bikers for years, and they have all this stuff back here. I bet you we could find things to make some weapons out of and so on.
I did think it was interesting, just the whole thing of, like, they have, like, off, like, it's the most 90s thing possible, but it works. Like, what's like a 90s kid going to gravitate towards? Oh, whoa, a super soaker? But this is one of the few cases, like, okay, yeah, make it holy water. Then there you go.
Well, it's funny because it literally goes full tilt, like, Zombies Ate My Neighbors, because Zombies Ate My Neighbors, that's the main weapon, is a super soaker of blessed holy water.
Yeah, it's holy water, and then, like, George Clooney has like a jackhammer with a stake at the end. Juliette Lewis has gone just like, whatchamacallit, has gone like basically Buffy the Vampire Slayer with a crossbow. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Keitel is basically, he's has a shotgun, but he's holding something else like this to make it a cross so we can back him up. Like,
he's got
like
the bat or whatever he found behind the bar.
Yeah, which this movie is ballsy in the sense, because you think that both kids are going to make it out, but no, like, Ernest Liu does not make it out. And you feel bad for him, because it's his own dad that bites him, but he manages, and the effect they get on him, because he hits his dad in the side of the head, because his dad turns, he's unable to stop him in time, his dad bites him, and then he chucks and hits the blessed water balloon in the side of his dad's face, and half of his head is missing, but he's still alive. And then I think he kills him somehow. I don't remember how exactly. And then he is then attacked by a bunch of vampires at once, and Juliette Lewis has to shoot him, and the kid blows up. Actually blows up.
Yeah, full on. Yeah, you know, I guess there's like no real reason why he blows up. He just does.
It looks cool.
Yeah, like that's
all bad for him. It looks cool.
You know, one of those ones. And then, as the night goes on, then, like, there's holes start appearing. The sunlight comes out. And as these vampires are all, like, circling upon George Clooney and Juliette Lewis, it finally breaks through, or Cheech Marin, his third character, breaks in. And then it kills all the vampires and whatnot. And they're able to get out. And it turns out that Cheech, in his third form, was apparently who George Clooney was supposed to meet down here the whole time to go to El Rey.
And he's just like, do you have any idea what the fuck just happened? And he's just like, what? I just see this bar out there. So there's never any cops around out here. I figured it'd be a good place to meet. Have you been inside there? No, I'm going to fucking man. Just drove past it a few times.
He's like, my brother fucking died. He's like, well, that sucks, man. You want some beer? I got domestic or foreign.
And then he's like, I will say some of like, that's also one of those moments where it's just kind of like what seems like a very like Tarantino-esque dialogue to me. He said, like, you said a brand new car. He says, like, it's 1990, man. 1990s might as well be new. My cousin only rode it like 6 times on a job. Nothing happened. Like, you said new 6 years, but whatever. You know, yeah, I know enough, bro. You know, that sounds like Tarantino dialogue to me right there.
Yeah, like that kind of stuff that, like, it really has, it's like, and it has throwaway lines, but they're very interesting. Like, it has nothing to do with anything going forward, but just commentary.
Context.
Yeah, just adds context and adds commentary and just, yeah, that kind of stuff there. And then, yeah, that's where you get to where George Clooney goes to El Rey with Cheech, and then Juliette Lewis is left with the motorhome to figure her way. She's just one of those odd ones. She's going to drive back to, like, the U.S. or whatever and be like, oh, it seems you came in here with your father and brother. The hell are those guys now?
Well, he gave her a stack of money, not all of his money, just a stack for her to probably go start a new life if she wanted to. And I'd like to think she went off vampire hunting. I'd like to think that's what she did.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, that, I'll say this, that would make for the more interesting sequel, as if Juliette Lewis was the main character of the second one, and then she's like, got nowhere else to go, but I got a Winnebago and a cross.
Yeah. Well, they did have like two or three straight to DVD sequels, and I watched the first one, and it's more of what I saw was more of just like, it's not really a sequel. It just takes place in that area. It takes place like the day before or day, like the day after, actually day before. And it's just a different group of people. And it felt very like just, you know, very sci-fi channel, just happy rated R, and of kind of like trying that thing of like that thing that a lot of like, I think up and coming filmmakers are trying to do, which is ape Tarantino and try to make it like overly like elaborate shots and very like someone's turning like a safe dial and the camera's turning with it, like that kind of shit. You know what I mean? So it was very meh. I never saw the other ones, but.
Yeah, I just remember seeing, I think I just saw the second one, because I think that was the one that had Robert in it for like a moment. I think he was even like a cameo character. I don't think he was even like a full one. But yeah, those sequels were just kind of those ones where I felt like Robert Rodriguez and Tarantino were just like, they're like, you know what?
Do it if you want.
Here's an extra paycheck for us. Let's not worry about it. We'll put our names as executive producers and we're out of here.
Yeah. Danny Trejo was in it, but who else did you say? What, did you
Robert
say Danny
Patrick? Trejo?
Yeah, oh yeah, he was somebody in it. Well, it was an interesting concept. Robert Patrick was like the second one, because it was an interesting concept. It was like cop and a criminal that was in and out of jail all the time that had to work together. And I think they're at a motel and something happened where a couple of vampires were attacking the motel nearby or some shit like that. It wasn't very good, but it had an interesting concept, you know, like I think there's something always about kind of like that Westernish that Western setting, but with like vampires or horror type stuff. I just think it's always interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of like the second John Carpenter Vampires one has sort of that kind of Western thing with the one's got Bon Jovi in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, which one?
The second John Carpenter's Vampires movie.
Oh, that one's really good. Yeah. It was very like, where they have to shoot, like they shoot stakes into like a motorhome during the day and they pull the vampires out that way into the sun.
Well, I think that's in the second one too, but that's the first one definitely has all that. The second, I was talking, the second one is the one that has Bon Jovi, but it has sort of a Western feel to it.
Well, I haven't seen the second. The first one still had a Western feel to it, I believe. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah.
No, that's another good. That movie's pretty much in like a very similar category as From Dusk Till Dawn, but that's a good one there too. But yeah, it's one of those ones. Yeah, I remember the sequel's just like, it was kind of like a bummer because it's like they could be awesome for From Dusk Till Dawn, you know. It's that thing that. I mean, even just the ending shot, it has one of those cool, like, lock-off kind of, like, as it's panning away from the bar from the backside and Juliette Lewis is driving off in the Winnebago, she's literally got, or it shows the bar, and on the backside of the bar, there's all these trucks and everything like that, and it's, like, almost like junk pile, but as it keeps going farther and farther back, you realize the bar is actually just built on a giant, like, almost like Mayan-like pyramid or something like that, you know?
Well, that was a cool thing about it, just because... when you see the bar, it's just like, oh, look, they got kind of like a Mayan pyramid thing going on. And then it zooms out of the back. Oh, it is literally a Mayan pyramid that's sticking out the back there. And they've like junked through all the, they've been pushing all the fucking, trucks and whatnot off the edges when they're done with them and just been building up this big ass junk pile behind it. And just like at the same time, though, there's also like this one little thing we forgot to add. Like initially, they don't want to serve them when they come to the bar. Like, no, you guys can't be here. Get gone. And then they're like, well, technically, this is a truck driver's license. Technically, we're allowed to be here. It's like, okay, if you insist, because their thing is like, you don't realize the time, but they want truckers and they want bikers because they want people who, if they're off driving and disappeared, no one would think to go look for them, which I thought that was kind of an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, no one would go look for them, except for the manufacturers or whatever goods were in their trucks. Probably like, damn it, we lost another one out there. You know what? We got to send a search crew out there because we're losing product left and right. You know what I mean?
Off like bootleg, off like if it was like Disney, like, oh, is this guy carrying like Disney toys? No, get the fuck out of here. Sorry. No, you're fine. You're go. Or if it's like bootleg shit, then like, get the fuck out. You know, condoms. Okay. That's a good point. I didn't think about that, but yeah.
But
I mean, I'm just thinking that's the logic they're probably making for it, you know, because why else would they turn down a family or something?
Yeah, because, yeah, they don't want that, you know. And then, yeah, everybody else is like, well, you know, technically to drive a Winnebago, you need to have a trucker license. Nobody does, you know, but you're supposed to. Well, that's what a good Samaritan would do. That's what me, Harvey Keitel, would do. Okay, just stop. Okay, yeah. Go sit down.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm doing the right thing, damn it. You know, I'm questioning God all at the same time. You questioning God? I bet you don't. Look at my kids here. Aren't they beautiful? Those are your kids? Yeah, why? They don't look like me? What are you,
don't look like the guy
you racist
taxi
like
driver?
George Clooney over here? He doesn't even know what the difference between an Asian is.
You mean tell me they don't look like the pimp from Taxi Driver? Yeah.
You know, in Taxi Driver, I was the only white pimp. You know that's a mystery, that apparently doesn't exist? Well, I made it exist. Damn it, I'm Harvey Keitel.
Four shots.
Yeah, four shots. And believe me, I won't get naked in this movie. It's for your sake. You know, I want to. I really want to, because that's what I do in movies. I get naked, and it really confuses the audience, because they didn't expect to see me naked, and they really wish they didn't see me naked, but there I am, naked.
It's kind of like a thing, like, I'm not doing it for them, I'm doing it for me, but at the exact same time, I think it's best for your tolerance, you know? You know, I think it makes you stronger at the end of the day. If you're still in that seat, congratulations.
You know, I did a movie once of Sam Neill, and, you know, I just wanted to kind of one-up his Jurassic Park thing by getting naked.
And that pussy Sam Neill, he never flashed his cock when he was getting attacked by a raptor.
No, but you know what? So I got naked in it, and, you know, that's what people remember from that movie. They don't remember what the title of the movie is. They just remember, they go, you know that movie had Sam Neill and Harvey Keitel in it? Yeah. Wasn't it weird that Harvey Keitel was like 60 years old and naked in it, like full on? Yeah, that was weird.
That wasn't even in the script. I just walked out on the set that day, like, hey, check this out. God, you know, damn it, Harvey.
Film's expensive, so they print it anyways.
You know, National Treasure, whenever I'm in shot, you know it's always shot, like, from the waist up, right? You know the reason why is?
You know, you could blame it on Martin, really. He made that whole scene where I was naked for, like, 10 minutes with the Doors playing over the top in the 60s.
Yeah. He's knocking at my door or whatever.
Yeah. It's just started a trend, and I just thought, you know what, this is how life should be, and I'm never gonna stop, and you're never gonna make me
more power to
yeah. Okay, sir. Yeah, great. The truck license, good. I'm glad you had it. You did not need to add in that whole other story that I'm not even too sure what that had to do with.
I wonder if, because every so often, like, because they're going down the line, like, Marvel eventually gets, like, everybody, and they got Harrison Ford playing I'm hoping he comes in as Red Hulk, but they got Harrison Ford as Thunderbolt Ross playing William Hurt, or replacing William Hurt. So I'm like, well, you finally got Harrison Ford. Who else is left as far as, like, big legacy people like that? You know, so I'm thinking of people
Clint
who
Eastwood.
Could, like, what? Well, I mean, Clint Eastwood, yeah, he's not going to do a Marvel movie. He's not going to. But, like, I'm just thinking people of, like, in that range of thing, like someone like a Harvey Keitel. Like, I mean, I guess you can come, like, playing kind of like a mentor, or kind of like, a mentor figure, or some, or like someone, like some kind of like a, or like an older villain who's like a corporatist or something like that. And I'm thinking, like, Harvey Keitel, oh no, he's going to come in. He's going to drop his pants as soon as he fucking gets there. Like, God damn it, Harvey, this is gonna be PG-13. Oh, it was. Is it Deadpool 3? No, it's Fantastic 4. Like, oh, well, you know
what? Fantastic Four, the last four have had an issue, right? Well, you know why. They weren't R. They didn't have the Harvey in there. You know,
yeah.
You don't have 83-year-old Harvey in this.
You know, it's not so. It's, what makes this four so fantastic? My Fantastic Eight, that's what it is. Yeah, it's 8 inches. Fucking get the measure. Get this fucking tape measure out. Check that shit. Harvey, goddamn.
We already paid him, so I guess keep it in there. Digital's expensive.
We'll fix it in post. Marvel. That's their tagline. Fix it in post.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, but yeah, no, I mean, I'm glad we watched From Dusk Till Dawn, because it's been a while since I've seen it. It's such a good movie. Like, it's one of those ones, you put it on, and it's kind of hard to, like, almost even, like, put a pause break into it because you're like, man, it's just captivating the whole way through, you know, especially when you're just kind of like, oh yeah, this scene comes up next here, or like you kind of forget for a moment what rolls around next. But yeah, this is just like that glory period where just like both Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez were just like throwing out stuff left and right, you know, and sometimes they're kind of like some of those movies that like sort of get kind of forgotten. But then you kind of go, oh, yeah, that movie's amazing. It's like kind of like The Faculty. That's like another Robert Rodriguez one that's like super solid.
That's a really good movie. Yeah, I like The Faculty. This, I don't know if it's my favorite Rodriguez movie. It's probably my second or third favorite, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's like Desperado.
Yeah, that's mine.
Then this, probably.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. I used to watch this movie all the time. It's not that it's bad, just, you know, time gets by you and you're like, oh wow, it's been like 7 or 8 years since I last watched From Dusk Till Dawn or Snatched or, you know, just a lot of those movies you'd watch in like your early 20s, late teens, you know.
Well, I think also too, you don't think about it, but there used to be a time period where, you know, you only had 100 movies, give or take, at your house to choose from. So, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, there's TV and things like that. But beyond that, though, like that was the thing, is like, so you circulate, I think, the movies you had a lot more often, where like once your collection starts building up, and then now that, you know, you have even more ways to kind of find and watch things. Plus, there's always those weird things you discover movies. You're like, I didn't know about this one, or where the hell was this movie my whole life? You know, and so you're finding stuff and like that. So that fills up the void. But I think that's sort of what it was. Is, yeah, when back in the day, you're like, yeah, you had your set of movies and you kind of watched them a little bit more like religiously because that was what you had and that was what you studied, you know, mm-hmm. And you threw them on the background and all that kind of stuff. Or you had, you know, back in the, I feel in the old days too, you know, you would get a movie and then you'd have to show like, you know, your 10 other friends in like the course of a month. So you got like a lot more watches out of stuff in like that process.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, this is just one of the movies I haven't watched in a while, but I still remembered it really well. And yeah, this is probably one of my favorite horror films. I think like vampire wise, this might be my favorite vampire movie, maybe like Fright Night right behind it. But even though Fright Night's more classic vampire, this is more of like, I guess if we're doing rules of classic vampires, I guess Fright Night. But overall movies, probably this over Fright Night.
Yeah, this one just has more like old school, like zombie monster vampire, like before they had, where they're closer to zombies, I feel like, than they are to like what modern vampires, I guess, or modern as in like the last 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of style. But yeah. No, it's just such a good one. And just basically kind of, I do want to go through, I've been thinking, saying it for a while, just go through some of those other like Robert Rodriguez / other Tarantino ones I haven't seen in a, seems like a good while. And just, that's some of one of the best things you can do in life is you throw on a classic old movie. That's almost one of the best experiences you can always have. You know, it's like, it's been a while that it almost gives it like sort of a fresh feel, yet you know it still well. Yeah, something cool. But continue on with more fun stuff coming up soon and so on like that. But till then, go to oldmanorange.com where you can find more podcasts, comic books like Pizza Boys, animations, videos, and all that other fun stuff. Till then, I'm Spencer Scott Holmes.
And I'm Ryan Dunningham.
And we'll see you some other time.
Later, folks.